Welcome back, everybody, to the Cave of Solitude, your pop culture and comic book podcast, coming to you from the megacity metropolis of Toronto. I am your host, Eric Anthony, and today we are coming to you on location in Midtown Toronto with today's special guest. I'm very, very happy to have him on the show finally. He is a writer, he is an artist, and he's the connoisseur of everything us fanboys love. We are with the sensational Sam Noir. Welcome to the show, Sam.
Glad to be here.
So we are currently at Pickle Barrel at Yonge and Eglinton. The best way to start the podcast is to get something to eat, something to drink, and then we can get into our geek conversation. So if you hear some ambient noise of people eating and people celebrating birthdays or cheers, it's all part of the atmosphere. I hope you enjoy it. So getting down to topics at hand, we could talk about just about anything.
And we have. Prior to this, over dinner, we should have been recording our dinner conversation.
We could have like a whole new series of podcast episodes.
There you go. Just dinner.
Yeah. So let's take it back to the beginning for you.
Alrighty.
So, were you born and raised in Toronto?
Just north of Toronto. So, Unionville.
Okay.
But close enough that I could experience downtown,
okay,
the downtown culture.
So how old were you when you came? Did you grow up in Unionville up until adulthood?
I was born in North York.
Okay.
And then,
which part of North York?
I'm trying to remember. I was a babe. Don Mills area. I was born in North York General.
Okay.
I know that. And again, I was too young to remember. But essentially, I think we lived North York, when I was really little, North York, Scarborough.
Okay.
And then, basically, I like to say, raised in 905 Unionville, which, again, basically, we're at that point where we're this, bedroom community to Toronto.
Right. So, getting into the genres and mediums that you are so known for now, what was your earliest memory of, I guess you could say, geek culture for
you?
Oh
boy. Well, comics were pretty prevalent as a kid, and again, this was when there were, again, this is sort of the tail end of the newsstand era,
okay,
as we call it. So back then, not only did you have the Marvels, DCs, but you had Archie, Harvey Comics was still around, so I have a memory of Harvey Comics, Gold Key and Whitman Comics, so the Disney comics, all that kind of thing. I have vague memories of Charlton, and so those were the sort of earliest comic book memories, but I think you and I earlier had a discussion, we have a commonality,
right,
in terms of Super Friends,
right,
or
right,
as they're later, in the later incarnation, the Super Powers team, was
yeah,
that
that's right,
the title, so that was a driving memory for me, as well as the superhero TV cartoon, and was essentially we had for movies at the time, so the Hulk TV show was a big one. The Wonder Woman, Linda Carter show was a huge one. Batman 66 and
the
Green
Hornet.
Did you
have a favorite of the three?
Oh boy, you know what? It's hard to choose from your favorites. The Hulk, in retrospect, was fantastic. But you know what? Here's the dark horse in the running that really stood out for me, even though it wasn't the best show. The live action Spider-Man.
Okay.
That was very short-lived. It was, I can't even remember. It's terrible in retrospect, but this live-action TV series, I think, was on around the same time as the live-action Hulk, and also there was a live-action Doctor Strange.
Right.
As well, but this is not to be confused with another memory I have, which is the Electric Company. Live
okay,
action.
I've heard about that.
We were very lucky. And the third, I'm a huge Spider-Man fan. I think
we've had this
conversation. You and I are both Spider-Man fans. And
yeah,
that original live action TV show from the 70s isn't very defensible these days when you watch it back then. But as a really young child, as one of your earliest memories, just seeing him you know, dynamic. Seemingly yeah. walk on the walls was pretty mind-blowing, you know, for a small child that didn't grow up in the era of CG effects and, you know, wirework martial arts stunts. It was pretty groundbreaking at the time. You know, of course, now you look at it, obviously, he's just doing the arm movements as they're sort of winching him up. But, here's the other thing. Another early memory for me is a third live-action Spider-Man that drove me nuts as a kid, because I would visit my grandmother in Hong Kong. In Hong Kong, they had four channels, but they would also show a lot of Japanese shows, either dubbed to Cantonese or with subtitles, like, you know, in Japanese with Chinese subtitles. But I discovered a Spider-Man TV show there, a live-action TV show, where Spider-Man was this Asian dude, this really cool Asian dude who rode around in a motorcycle. And then he had a spider car and a giant transforming robot. And he fought what looked to me like Godzilla monsters.
That sounds almost like things that you might see out of the Spider-Man Worldwide.
Well, here's the thing. You run to the YouTube now, you can watch this. It's called Spider-Man. And as we discovered, Marvel licensed Spider-Man and other characters to Japan to do their own TV show. And so this was apparently a popular show in the 70s, where Spider-Man was given their twist. So I would come back to Toronto.
Yeah.
And I would tell all the kids that I have seen this amazing Spider-Man show where he's fighting Godzilla monsters and he's got a race car and a giant transport. And no one would believe me. They thought I was either talking about Electric Company.
Right, right.
Because he would run into weird creatures on Electric Company, too. You know, a creature that looked like a wall or whatever.
Right, right.
Or the live-action North American short-lived TV show as well, and that wasn't the case, but no one believed me. There wasn't the internet back then. There wasn't.
That must have been frustrating.
It was a little. It was like.
Because your brothers, you have brothers, correct?
Yes, yes. So, they were. One wasn't born yet, and the other was quite young. Oh,
so you're
even
the oldest
them,
of three.
Yeah, even with them as corroborators,
right?
You know, it's not quite.
People would have thought, "Oh, your little brother's just agreeing with you,"
or something like that. Yeah, I can't remember, but I remember it was almost like when Big Bird's trying to tell people about Snuffleupagus, or. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
People, you're lying, or you're just remembering it wrong.
Right.
So for 20 years, up until the early internet, when I finally found a clip of Suba, and it was everything I had remembered. If you do get a chance, jump on YouTube, and it's hilarious. The show is absolutely but wonderful. And this show actually was the precursor to Power Rangers. The
really?
Same production company that had done Spider-Man. Well, there's the formula for Power Rangers, right?
Yeah.
Here's a spandex costume superhero with a giant transforming robot fighting essentially kaiju monsters.
Right.
And the second spin-off show that Marvel was going to do in Japan was supposed to be based on Captain America. And this eventually became... I don't even think it's even related to Marvel in any way, but a group of five from around the world. So you had, I can't remember, Battle Japan. It was called Battle Fever Japan. And you had, the female character was from America, and I think there might have been like a German or Nigerian. They were five different Power Rangers-like costume, you know, the spandex, the helmets, who had a giant transforming robot, if I'm remembering correctly.
What was it called?
Battle Fever Japan, if I'm remembering correctly.
I remember vaguely a movie that I remember renting. I was around 10 years old during the Power Ranger craze, and it was from Japan.
Okay.
But it was basically like a template
were Power Rangers.
Oh, yeah.
That it looked like it came, like, this was what the Power Rangers based themselves on. I don't remember the name of it, but it sounds familiar
to
me. Well,
Ultraman, Ultraman was sort of in the ballpark, you know, in terms of live action here, but in terms of the specific Power Rangers formula, that was Battle Fever Japan, and then the next incarnation was, my memory's terrible, the Rangers. So was the earliest version of the Power Rangers. So there's actually a fascinating lineage from Spider-Man to the Power Rangers that not a lot of people know about. But it's all stuff you can look up on the... You can fall into a hole watching these clips or reading up about it online. Like, this is just sort of my vague memory. But that, to me, was an amazing Spider-Man memory. And remember Spider-Verse a couple of years ago?
Yes, yes, yes.
There was a beautiful moment that no one knew coming in Spider-Verse, because there were a number of Japanese Spider-Men.
Right.
There, and most of them were in the manga. But there was a moment where the giant robot is called Leopardon. And Leopardon and Spider-Man showed up in Spider-Verse. And literally, I
flip out?
I was by myself in the living room or whatever, and I had a fist pumping moment, because here's a character from my childhood who I tried to convince everyone existed, but had no evidence, and now here he is in actual Marvel Comics canon.
That's
he
awesome.
Now exists in the 616 multiverse continuity.
Right, right,
right. It was a brilliant moment, and I'm glad Dan Slott was able to include that incarnation of Spider-Man.
That's great to find that, you know, that childhood memory or moment. Like, yes, someone remember. Like, you know, they've given it the credibility that I was trying to give it as a kid.
For sure, for sure. But to continue answering your question, other early influences, there were childhood toys. You and I have talked about your love of
superpowers.
Superpowers.
Yeah.
For me, the very first toys that I owned, and this was sort of late in the line, were the Mego superheroes. So this is where I first had my Spider-Man action figure. It was the 8-inch cloth Spider-Man, and of course there was Superman and Batman and Robin. And the wonderful thing about this was people are so hung up about Marvel or DC, Marvel versus DC, but they existed in the same toy line.
Yeah.
To me, it's perfectly natural that Spider-Man can hang out with Superman. And of course, we had the famous crossover comics.
Right.
Back then. There were two Superman meets Spider-Man comics back then, as well as Batman meets Hulk, which wasn't as good. And then there was a fantastic Teen Titans meets the X-Men.
Right.
So, you know what, to me, as long as it's a good story, as long as they're good characters, and we now live in the golden era of crossovers, where, you know, Predators are meeting aliens, who are meeting Judge Dredd, who are meeting Vampirella, right? So it's everyone is crossing, Green Lantern is crossing over with
Star Trek.
Yeah, and Planet of the Apes, apparently.
Yeah.
So, I have very fond memories of all the toys, and then, of course, eventually the Secret Wars toy line and the Superpowers toy line as well.
So, were comic books your... I mean, you mentioned the toys, so clearly the toys had, like, a deep connection to the universes of those characters.
Well, they were all part and parcel of the same thing. I don't think I really differentiated.
Right.
You know, sometimes, you know, you know, and again, I think people are too hung up on continuity.
Yes.
You know, Super Friends is obviously different than the Superman movie, let's say, which again also another huge influence, which is different than the comics at the time, but it's all Superman.
Right.
As long as the core of the character remains, I'm okay with different. It's mythology, right?
There's,
as a kid, I would read so many different accounts of, let's say, the Greek myths or the Roman myths or whatever, and basically, it's just different ways to tell the same story or different ways to look at a story from another angle. I'm totally okay with multiple interpretations, especially, their Japanese Spider-Man can live very, very comfortably alongside, my classic comic book Spider-Man, which I love.
Right.
Which I love.
So were comic books or the characters, superheroes, was that your first love, or did you also enjoy the other, consider now like those fanboy genre things?
In terms of, I was at the point where comics were all the same. Anything that even looked looked close enough to a comic, like comic strips, Tintin and Asterix, I could get at the library, I could get collections of the Peanuts, old comic collections, like even Orphan Annie. Little Orphan Annie or Little Abner, you could get those at the library. The library was a huge source of comics to me. The newsstand. One of my younger brothers spent a great deal of time in the hospital, for example. So the only comics you could get in the hospital were those Whitman Gold Key comics. So there were a lot of Mickey Mouse and Looney Tunes comics. When I was waiting in the hospital waiting room, Harvey Comics was a huge part of my childhood as well. Casper, Wendy, Richie Rich, Archie's, of course. So as long as it sort of looked like comics, I'd read them.
What was it about comic books for you?
I think it's just it's very powerful. At a young age, you see words and pictures. I mean, it's the same as picture books, right? What is it when a 3-year-old picks up a picture book? He responds to the words and pictures, and that's how a lot of kids can learn to read. I know I learned to read through comics, and as a result, became a voracious reader.
Right.
All through my childhood, once I graduated to prose. But to get back to your question, I have to say my first genre, I'm doing finger quotes, love, was superheroes. You know, as much as I liked all the other cartoon funny animals and Looney Tunes cartoons and what I now know as Carl Barks's Duck comics, as much as I loved all that sort of thing, superheroes between the cartoons, the movies, and even the comic strips. Because back then, Spider-Man, he still has a comic strip, doesn't he? There was a Spider-Man comic strip. There was
Stan's brother wrote that, right?
Stan wrote it, and his brother drew it for a while, I think.
Okay.
Larry Lieber? I think Larry Lieber, at least in the past couple of decades, was the artist after Romita.
Okay.
Stop doing it. If my memory's terrible, but Stan.
I think your memory's pretty good.
Even up until a few years ago, I think Stan, if he's still not writing it now, he was still writing it. So that comic strip was a huge deal for me. There was a Superman / Justice League comic strip back then. I remember there was a Hulk comic strip in the. There was a Howard the Duck comic strip. I remember very clearly. When I was young, all that kind of to sort of segue the question. If my first love is superheroes, in terms of genre, the second love came along. The first movie I ever saw was Star Wars.
Okay,
in the theaters at the Manulife Center, which is still around today. I remember vividly. I can't remember. It must have been. Kindergarten, I remember vividly going up those escalators to see it. And that definitely left an impression. And again, the Star Wars toys, the Star Wars movies, the Star Wars comic books, which were a little weird, I have to admit. They weren't quite Star Wars in my head, but thank goodness there was, I think it was Al Williamson and Archie Goodwin, if I remember correctly, doing the Star Wars comic strip. And I convinced my parents, like they were Toronto Star readers, but I managed to bug my parents, and they got a subscription to the Toronto Sun because that's how I could get Star Wars comics. Every Sunday.
Yeah, the sensibilities of liking, it's natural that a kid who likes superheroes and comic books would. There's something about Star Wars that appeals because whether people realize it or not. there's that, you can see that George Lucas was a fan of that genre.
Well, a fan of pulp as well.
Yes,
like,
exactly.
They all have their origins in the same place, which is pulp fiction, and as a result, serial fiction, right?
Right.
So you've got the earliest pulp heroes like The Shadow and Doc Savage and all those eventually evolved. Actually, the earliest Marvel publications were pulps.
Right.
Just before the comic. I think Kazar and a few others originated in the pulps before that very first Marvel Comics number one with Namor and the Human Torch and the original Angel, if I remember correctly.
But some people have said that certain aspects of what Lucas was taking from for Star Wars, he was borrowing heavily from Jack Kirby's, like, the fourth world stuff, like Dark Side, and
maybe.
I don't know.
I can see an argument for that. I'd have to say, probably, you know,
Flash Gordon,
being
of
the
course,
being the enormous fan that, and there's been rumors for years that Lucas wanted to do a Flash Gordon film,
yes,
couldn't get the rights, and so did his own instead, which turned out better.
Right.
I'm not quite, like, people point out the Jack Kirby influence. I'm not quite so sure. I do know the two main ones would be the, let's say, the Buster Crab, Flash Gordon movie serials, which he grew up on, if I'm remembering correctly. And the other huge influence, which I'm a fan of, my dad grew up with samurai movies. So I think it's well documented that Lucas has cited the hidden Kurosawa's The Hidden Fortress as the other main influence. And I think actually if Mifune claims, whether or not this is true, at one point he was approached to play Darth Vader. And you see in all those early Ralph McQuarrie artwork, Darth Vader's helmet looks like a samurai helmet.
That's true.
It's all on the internet. It's all in the different books I've read over the years about the samurai meets Flash Gordon influence. Lucas, of course, was that first generation of filmmakers coming out of film school, along with, you know, Scorsese and Spielberg and all the rest of those guys. So
they all went together, right? Weren't they, like,
a lot of them were at UCLA. I can't remember if they necessarily went together or not. I'm sure a lot of them did. A lot of them went straight from film school and worked for, I want to say, Francis Ford Coppola?
Yes.
THX.
Yes.
That's right. The original THX film was for Coppola, right?
Yeah, I think so. So, this just occurred to me.
Oh, and Roger Corman. A lot of them worked for Roger Corman.
That's
as
right.
Well.
Roger Corman, who famously is known for the Fantastic Four movie. So, this just occurred to me as you were mentioning all of those comic books that you enjoyed, from, you know, Superhero to Orphan Annie.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think there's something that the way that being raised off of reading comic books or learning to see the world through that kind of viewpoint, do you think it affects the way you will see life later on in life? It seems like a little bit of a...
I think so. Like, I also
as
think...
opposed to just reading, you know, prose all the time, because you're visualizing and seeing dialogue, it kind of, I don't know, it just kind of, do you think that happens?
I'm mostly a writer these days, but I did train for years and years as an artist. Just to get back to that, I tend to visualize my stories.
Right.
In a way, I think, and again, I think you and I were having an earlier conversation about how cartoonists, people who write and draw their own things, tend to create versus someone who merely draws or merely writes. So I do think a lot in terms of story, but I also think visually as well. At a ridiculously early age, I don't think anyone would do this in this day and age. I got sent down to the Art Gallery of Ontario to take art classes. And from Unionville, I would have to take, like, numerous buses and subways. I think it was 2 hours to get down there and 2 hours to get back. And I might have been 10 when I first started.
On your own?
On my own, yeah, yeah. Wow. I think I went with the first couple of times. I went down with my uncle who was commuting. Okay. At the time. So during the summers and weekends, from around, I want to say the age of 10, I took classes. And I'm a suburban kid.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Going down to the city, and that had a huge impact. But also, I don't think of myself as much of an artist. I'll admit this, even though I went all the way, my degree is in fine art, actually, at Queen's University. So I have a degree in fine art studio concentration where I painted, I did installation sculpture, I did sculpture, I did printmaking. So there is a huge visual component to my creative life, but there was also the storytelling component, I think, which is the comics thing. And that's something, at least in terms of my secondary education at a fine art school, I always wanted a narrative, which probably drove the professors there a little nuts, because I was always, as opposed to, you know, the visual or emotional. That's part of it, but I always wanted to tell a story. But if we're sort of leaping back to the beginning, there was a huge influence when you're a suburban kid living in a bedroom community of Toronto, and then coming downtown for the first time and experiencing the art gallery. You're a fan of art galleries. We've had this conversation.
Yeah.
So just imagine, as a young person for the first time, being just sort of dumped into art culture. The other thing is, it was my first experience with, I'm doing finger quotes again, downtown kids.
Right.
So you were literally in classes on during the summer or on weekends with kids that I describe as looking like they stepped out of Degrassi. You know, as a preppy kid from the suburbs, you watch these shows and they're full of, you know, new wave kids and punk kids, kids with, you know, nose rings and safety pins through their cheeks and mohawks. And for the first time, I hung out with these kids. And there was and it's these kids that actually, on break, they take me down to Queen Street. And we would go to the comic store. The comic store's down there, so the Dragon Lady was there, the Silver Snail was down there. There was a used bookstores down there, Baca Books, the science fiction bookstore was there. Record store, so I got into cool music. At the, you know, I figured out what punk and new wave was at an early age. All alternative music that they were listening, that these, again, I'm doing finger quotes, downtown kids were listening to what we called CFNY at the time. Now it's called The Edge, and it's a lot more mainstream.
Yeah.
But, it was revelatory to suddenly be thrown in amongst all this culture, like music culture and book culture and, of course, comics culture. And a lot of these kids at the gallery school were into comics as well. So there was that degree of creativity that you sort of threw into your early printmaking or painting or sculpting efforts.
So what was your, you talk about being a suburban preppy kid, in the suburbs, then you come into the city. How did your parents feel now that they were seeing you, you know, be with these other kids who had all of these different individual ideas? Were they scared? I don't think
it appeared much on the surface, to be honest. I'd come home, I'd have freaky artwork, but artwork is artwork, right?
On
the outside, I still looked tall. You know, I don't think there was much of a difference that way. It's
no clothespins in your face.
Again, I still wanted to fit in with the kids in 905, right? And keep in mind, Unionville back then was still the whitest of the white communities. Ironically, it's the new Chinatown in the past 20 years, but at the time, we were kind of the Chinese family. up there in Unionville. So you try your best to sort of fit in. But on the flip side, there was a rich internal life there, and then you found people that sort of shared those passions as well. Suddenly, you know, you discover the comics that really disturb and upend you, shall we say. So there was the safe comics, and then all of a sudden, because of comic stores, and then you started noticing on the adult magazine rack, you had creepy, eerie, Vampirella, heavy metal, Epic Illustrated, all these quote-unquote adult comics. And then from there, you also discover underground comics. And it's all part and parcel with the evolution of your taste as well. So as a result, your taste in other pop culture, movies, music, starts to get a little more edgier, gets to become a little more dangerous. You know what I mean? It's a, so I don't think it's necessarily, as much as I love comics, it's culture as a whole that sort of opened up to me.
Yeah.
In that way. I keep forgetting that this probably was a relatively unique situation. Like, it would be unheard of now for anyone to send their 10-year-old unaccompanied for a 2-hour bus ride there and a 2-hour bus and train subway ride back to attend a gallery school. And essentially, I learned to run around downtown as well. Like, just all my... And then I started taking my friends.
Right.
You find like-minded friends who are sort of, oh, hey, your older brother's into heavy metal and creepy, you know? Let's go down to the Silver Snail, and they have collected editions of Richard Corbin stuff or Robert Crumb stuff. Or, you know, at the time, Marvel was experimenting with different formats and creator-owned comics, right? There was Epic Illustrated, which was their version of heavy metal. But from there, Archie Goodwin had his own imprint, which was Vertigo Comics.
Wow.
Before Vertigo. I discovered Epic Comics on the newsstand. So they were reprinting Gru the Wanderer and ElfQuest on the newsstands.
Okay.
Which was kind of mind-blowing when you think about it, that those two sort of early... also, Mad Magazine. I'll digress a little and say Mad Magazine, huge influence as well. But from there, you had other... So this, I think my tastes are quite diverse, because all of a sudden Epic Comics had like... almost a steampunk science fiction comic series called The Boz Chronicles. I think it was David Michelinie and Brett Blevins. Had an alien Sherlock Holmes running around Victorian England with a Victorian prostitute as his Watson. And it's a hidden gem. I still love this series to death. I don't know if it's still in print, but you had something called Time Spirits that Epic did that was two Native Americans that traveled through time, like Marty from Back to the Future. You know what I mean?
Right.
I think it had more akin to... Voyagers. I don't know if you remember this TV show. It was, again, a time travel or sliders or whatever. Just, Epic, under Archie Goodwin, was doing some incredibly inventive things that were really expanding the genre. What we referred to as Vertigo books before Vertigo, Mike Kaluta and the Lane Lee Starstruck was also... Their science fiction opera with gorgeous, gorgeous art. I'm trying to remember what else. What were we talking about? I keep digressing.
No problem. I love it.
But Silver Snail was a revelation.
That was a spot.
Yes, and I've sort of discovered this after the fact. There's a gentleman, I don't know if you know, named Mark Asquith. He's a producer at Space now, but he's very plugged into the Toronto comic scene. And there was a newsletter at the time that I later found out was written by Mark, where the Silver Snail newsletter would make recommendations. And amongst those recommendations was something called Violent Cases by an unheard of British creative team named Neil Gaiman and Dave McKeon. And again, as a young kid at the art gallery school, I, on the recommendation of Mark Ashworth in this newsletter, I picked up Violent Cases, the very first work by these two, and as someone who's also going to art school, this was a revelation as well. You know, Bill Sienkiewicz was at the time admittedly doing multimedia artwork as well, but something about Dave McKeon's work and almost the child's point of view that Neil Gaiman was writing from in Violent Cases really, really spoke to me, like, especially as a young person reading this memoir of Neil Gaiman, looking back at his childhood and his inaccurate memories. I don't know if you've ever read Violent Cases.
No, I haven't. But that sounds interesting, the inaccurate memories of your childhood. Yeah. That's cool.
But, and again, this was the gateway to Vertigo Comics. And it's funny, I just kind of looking back, this is almost like therapy, isn't it?
No, that's good. That's good. That's what it's supposed to be.
You probably had this experience. At a certain point, you discover girls.
Yeah.
And, you know, you think, I don't need comics anymore.
It's the girls and music that replace
yes.
the...
Exactly. You start going to concerts. But at a time when, you know, comics were starting to admittedly bore me a little, is also around the time that there was a huge upheaval in the industry. Yeah, I was starting to discover these, you know, creepy, eerie, heavy metal, which was kind of cool, but it was the 1-2 punch, I think, of Watchmen and Dark Knight Returns. Yeah. I remember...
The Game Changer,
along with a lot of other stuff. Like, The Shadow, we were talking earlier about Chaikin Shadow. That came out around the same time. Alan Moore's Swamp Thing came out a little earlier, so I had started reading that, and then I discovered...
There's, like, these precursors that are leading to these two huge pop culture phenomena.
But, basically, I remember this very clearly. You know, you're on the bust camp. And, you know, you're a burgeoning adolescent having these feelings for these girls around you. But I had, on a whim, because I wanted something to read on the bus, I think picked up The Dark Knight Returns, the very first book. It was the second printing of it, too, at the Silver Snail. And I remember, you know, again, you're a little embarrassed to be reading a comic, but I consumed The Dark Knight Returns on this 2-hour bus ride to sleepaway camp. It was mind-blowing. I was haunted by this book because it spoke to me in a way that comics hadn't before. It had depth. It had what we think of what, you know, I might have at the time thought about as adult sensibilities. My definition of adult sensibilities has shifted since, you know, then, but
at the time it was
at
because
the time, yes.
Even the way it was laid out, the way it was drawn, it was kind
the
of
pacing, the way he integrated media,
yes,
the painted colors of it, the fact that it had a square bound spine.
There was something that made it feel important,
and it felt like a paradigm shift to me. It felt like a genuine, like, as much as, you know, it I had the guilty pleasures of peeking into comics that were inappropriate for me. Let's say heavy metal or creepy Vampirella, that kind of thing. Dark Knight spoke the language of superheroes, so it was sort of melding of the childhood self with the burgeoning adolescent self. And there was also a musicality to a lot of these early comics as well. Bill Sienkiewicz was talking about, I think, the influence of jazz on his work as he exploded into expressionistic multimedia stuff with stuff like Elektra Assassin, for example, and even his earliest New Mutants as he was getting more and more experimental and off the beaten path. So luckily, I think I was at the perfect age. I talked to a lot of friends who are a little older who reached that age, and then there was, other than, you know, let's face it, heavy metal is kind of adolescent. built for adolescents, right? Versus an adult story, let's say, with themes and overarching political awareness and all that. And that's what Dark Knight and The Watchmen had for me. They were real revelations. And from there I just hunted down everything I could of Alan Moore's, hunted down everything I could of Frank Miller's, led me to his early Daredevil work, and then he got wildly experimental. I think you remember Electra Assassin, there was Hard Boiled, his collaboration with Jeff Darrow. Have you ever seen this?
I've heard of it, but I never read it.
Yeah, and again, and then Martha Washington Goes to War. In terms of Alan Moore, Swamp Thing was one of my favorite titles. His Miracle Man, V for Vendetta, and then I even you mentioned about your love of the hunt for comics. So
yes,
I made it my mission to hunt down every obscure thing that Alan Moore, Frank Miller, and then the rest of the British invasion that followed. Grant Morrison, Garth Ennis, Neil Gaiman, hunted Mark Miller as well. I was on. There's some really obscure Grant Morrison, Mark Miller black and white books that were quite mind-blowing. One was called Savior, which he eventually, Mark Miller, did for a small press British company called Trident, which he eventually revisited as, I think it's now called American Jesus. So he took some of the seeds of Savior, which was, I like to say, the Dark Knight Returns of religious superheroes. And hardly, it's out of print, hardly anyone has ever heard of Savior, but I would lump it in there with Watchmen and Dark Knight. The premise is, do you know the British TV host Jonathan Ross?
I think so.
Yeah, he's married to Jane Goldman, who co-writes Matthew Vaughn's movies. So she co-wrote like X-Men First Class and Stardust and I think Kick-Ass and all that. But he's their version of Johnny Carson or David Letterman.
Yes.
So Mark Miller had the subversive thing of making his anti-hero, religious superhero essentially, Jonathan Ross. So to this day, those early influence, like, you know, Mark Miller is a very media savvy and media influenced guy. So even in those earliest comics. But these are a huge fan of British stuff to encapsulate in a nutshell.
But you see, that's what I was getting at before. You started off from enjoying that, and it branched off into this thing for artwork where you were a kid going to, and then you, all of these different ways of taking in media, whether it was music, whether it was artwork, comic books, the type of stories that you liked, it just completely opens you up to seeing things and trying new things out.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's such an interesting medium, I find, comic book media.
Well, the diversity of it, right?
Yes,
like, we were even talking earlier, I was actually very impressed, because we've had lots of superhero conversations, but in our earlier conversation, I felt a kindred spirit in you, because you're talking about biographies, protest comics, just the divert.
Which I'm starting to become a little bit more interested in now, because I've always, superhero comics have always kind of been my safe place, because
of course.
I've always enjoyed the morality tale of it.
Oh yeah.
So you know, some people like DC Comics because they're the original superheroes and they like to see their superheroes as gods, as it were. And then there's the soap opera aspect of Marvel, but all in all, it's that morality tale that I've always liked. But these other comics now are being able to tell you stories of people's childhoods.
Oh yeah.
You know,
well, as we were saying, true grown-up sensibilities, and now there's a comic for everyone.
Everyone.
Oh my God, your family is hard. Your family is difficult to, like, especially if they weren't into comics beforehand. But you said your wife is into protest comics.
Yeah.
So it's an interest of hers. For mine, it was fantasy sort of stuff.
Yeah.
So you know, you find the perfect comic, which was, I thought, was Bone.
Okay.
Which she enjoyed. But then she was in a comic store one day, just because I'm always in comic stores, and picked up Mouse Guard.
I've heard and of Mouse Guard.
Between the artwork and the story and the Lord of the Rings style storytelling, she found her book. Yeah. You know, the one that spoke to her. My dad had a bypass operation about a decade or so back, and he was stuck, you know, lying on his back for a long, long time. And, you know, we'd sit there and we'd talk about the samurai movies that, you know, we both love and he loved as a childhood. And I was a huge fan of Lone Wolf and Cub. Mm-hmm. Again, because Frank Miller introduced us to, in North America, to the original first comics reprints of Lone Wolf and Cub. But at the time, Dark Horse was doing these little pocket-sized manga. Yeah. So my dad, who had, you know, always kind of, he never got comics when I was growing up, but now as an adult, he's stuck in a hospital room, he devoured 20 plus volumes of Lone Wolf and Cub. The only person I haven't been able to find a comic for is my mom, but I'm
there's
sure...
There's one out there.
There is.
So. I think people just gotta get past the thing of thinking that a picture with word bubbles is meant for children.
Yes.
And there's so much adult sensibility, and it's amazing the stories that can be told with it, that there is literally a comic for everybody.
And the astonishing thing is now, because reading has become like such a commodity that people are valuing, so any way you can get your kids to read, I've discovered all of a sudden, because growing up, teachers weren't on board comics.
No.
That was junk literature. But now you talk to teachers, librarians, anything to get kids to read. All of a sudden, they get it. And they also get that there's biographies, there's nonfiction, it doesn't have to be... Let me put it this way. Superhero comics are shifting all the time.
Yeah.
And to be honest, if, you know, the current state, there are periods when I'm not quite into a lot of DC comics, or I'm not as into a lot of Marvel comics because of certain changes they made. But I can't get the head of steam, you know, I can't get upset about it. I see a lot of people getting upset about on the internet.
Yeah.
About it, because at the same time, my reading pile is so huge that it's like, okay, there's, you know, 5 or 8 or 10 Marvel and DC titles I don't have to pick up, and then over here I can finally get down to reading you know, something like just to pull out of my recent reading pile, there's Brian K. Vaughan's The Private Eye. Finally got around to reading that. Wicked and Divine by Karen Gillan, and I believe Jamie McKelvey. I finally gotten around to binge reading that. I really got to catch up on Saga. There's a comic called by Jason Shiga called Demon, which is one of the most published by First Second Comics, which is one of the more disturbing and brilliant comics out there. He draws very simple, sort of almost comic strip Muppety characters with dark sensibilities, coupled with the fact that, and this sounds weird, Jason Shiga has a master's, I believe, or a doctorate or something in mathematics, and he manages to incorporate math into the narrative of his comics in an almost seamlessly autistic way, if I can be so bold. It's a supernatural thriller that started off as a webcomic, and it's disturbing to the point that he never thought it'd be published by anyone. But lo and behold, First Second published it, and now 4 volumes of this is out. So I've managed to reread this in book form, and I'm glad, because I just don't have enough time to.
Yeah.
You and I were saying there are so much good stuff out there. Why dwell on the stuff that you don't care for? I get it. It's your home team,
right?
You know,
right,
Spider-Man's,
right.
You know, my guy. But on the flip side, if you know, the current not that I've been loving what Dan Slott's been doing at Chip Zdarsky's. Yeah. Recent issues have been quite excellent. J. Jonah Jameson, have you read he's done with J. Jonah?
A little bit, yeah.
There's a My Dinner with Andre, where Peter and Jonah have an entire issue just having dinner. And I think Chip Zdarsky did a brilliant job of distilling both these characters down. But, you know, let's in the hypothetical situation, if, you know, let's say the 5 or 6 Spider-Man comics I have to choose from, say a few of them aren't to my taste, that's okay.
There's so much to read.
Not gonna...
I can't keep up. I don't know. How do you find time to read comics? Like, because you seem to read... You've read so much in your life.
Well, here's what I used to do. I love my commute.
Loved
my commute when I had a commute.
Yeah, me too.
Now I don't. But the other thing is I use it as motivation to exercise. So I will get on the treadmill, put my iPad on there, and the longer I'm on the treadmill or the recumbent bike during the winters, the more I get to read comics. And also I usually fall asleep. So I'm a digital reader now, so I have my iPad and I'll read a little bit before I fall asleep is the other thing.
Same.
But it's
commute's the best. My wife says, I hate the commute, I just want to get home, and I would be like, I want to work in the city so bad.
Oh, how, like, even if
I can read all the time.
Even if the subway, because this is, like I told you as a child, I had a 4-hour round trip commute to get to art school at the AGO, and I had discovered these comic shops, Silver Snail, you know, where all of a sudden indie comics from Comico and First Comics, not only did I have a wealth of back issues, and, you know, so every day I'd have my little stack, and I love that 4-hour commute. It's like when I was a kid, long car rides, plane rides. I grew up at the track. Every Saturday, we would go to the horse track.
Okay.
My dad, you know, that was his weekly ritual, and he'd take the kids along, and I would just sit there and read comics, and I was okay with that. You know, I'd finished my homework, so I could just read to my heart. The Twilight Zone episode with Burgess Meredith? Are you familiar with the Twilight Zone?
I am, but I want to know.
Oh, okay. There's the beautiful... I think it's called All the Time in the World. And he's got... Burgess Meredith is this guy with Coke bottle glasses and a job and responsibility, but all he wants to do is read.
That's me.
Yeah, there's an ironic twist to it, but never before have I related to a genre character, you know, who honestly is not very, as a writer, you're always taught there needs to be sort of an active hero, but here's someone who all he wants to do is read, and never have I related to a character as much as this guy who could just happily read all day.
Right, yeah, I'm totally in that boat. So, speaking of relatable characters, was there a character that you related to the most growing up as a kid?
Spider-Man.
Why?
He was the everyman, and he messed up. And also, at the time he was in college, but you read those reprints, like there were pocketbook reprints of the Stan Lee Steve Ditko. He was a kid, just like you and I, right?
Yeah.
Like, people talk about how Robin was included in Batman.
Yeah.
He was introduced early so that the kids could have a relatable character.
Yeah.
But I think this was Stanley and Steve Ditko's brilliance. Here's a kid who you could relate to.
Yeah.
Who had the same who had problems just like you, who messed up just like you did. So I think this is why he is one of the top three characters of all time.
And who are your top three?
Top three? Oh boy.
I thought maybe you had it already right when you said Spider-Man.
Yeah, it shifts. But if I were for me, Spider-Man, I'm a big Sherlock Holmes fan. And, a third one is tough. Right now, I want to say Swamp Thing.
Okay.
I'm on a huge Swamp Thing kick. And again, because of Alan Moore originally, and then you discover the Len Wein writes and run after you discover that. And then there were so many great writers who've touched the character since then. Scott Snyder's recent run was great. Mark Miller, with Grant Morrison, did a run that, you know, is hugely underrated to me. Yeah, and the artists that have worked on the character have all been brilliant. But here's the other thing about Spider-Man, that a lot of... this is what... I'm gonna cite Brian Bendis and Miles Morales. Because people jumped all over Brian Bendis when he introduced Miles Morales, and he tried to describe what a lot of fans of color, you know, visible minorities who came up to him and said, the reason why I like Spider-Man is in the schoolyard, no one gave me a hard time about being Spider-Man. I could put on that Spider-Man Halloween mask and no one would question it. You know, I'm black, I'm Asian, I'm Indian, whatever. I could be Spider-Man. Like, anybody could be Spider-Man underneath there. And to be honest, that was my experience as well. Mm-hmm. I had my Spider... You know, you could put on your Superman thing and be told, oh, but Superman isn't Asian. Or, you know, whatever. Spider-Man, on the other hand, firsthand, I might add, was an Asian dude with a giant transforming robot and a car to me. Like,
you
one
saw,
of my early...
Saw
I saw that Spider-Man could be an Asian dude as well. So I was all on board with Miles Morales, and I understood what Bendis was trying to say. People sort of took his words out of context at the time, but he wrote a great character.
Yeah.
And it was a good, like, again, I get what people are saying. They don't want a change for the sake of change. But for me, if it's a good story, if he's got a good story...
He made a new character, though. It was different.
Yes.
It wasn't like they were recasting the character in a movie to look like...
Exactly.
It was a new character. Miles
and he's
Morales
in an alternate universe.
Yeah.
It's like Earth 1 and 2. Again, I never understood the backlash for it because, okay, if... We grew up with comics, and there's a multiverse out there, and there's Earth 1 Superman, Earth 2, there's 616 Spider-Man, and there's Miguel. There's already precedents. Miguel O'Hara, a visible minority who's Spider-Man 2099. No one blinked.
Yeah.
About
future.
Yeah. But Bendis gets a little bit of media attention, and folks. So I love multiple interpretations. So Spider-Man 2099 was a fun interpretation. There's some that are Spider-Gwen,
mm-hmm.
also a fun book. So I think there's room for diversity, and it doesn't have to be an either-or situation. And I think Spider-Man himself, this is the thing, Peter Parker himself would be a lot more open to it. And of course, that's the way Bendis wrote him.
Right.
He was very... open-minded about him while going, hey, that's my shtick, but okay,
yeah.
You're a good kid, and now I'm an adult and I can mentor you. It was at a time when he was also playing Tony Stark, right?
Yeah.
So you had the perk to me. Two different Spider-Men running around made sense because you had a young high school Spider-Man, and then you had Spider-Man running around with Tony Stark, and both were really well written.
Yeah.
Both spoke to me. If they weren't, then I just sort of, you know, put it away. It's and I'll read it some other time. So
yeah.
There's been runs on Spider-Man I haven't much cared for, but that's okay. I'll put it down for
now.
There's
tons of them that are good.
I'll go back and read the ones I love, because there's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years worth that I could just spend all my time rereading, even if there wasn't new Spider-Man produced in 8 different comics a month, right? So I mean, I can't even keep up with Spider-Man comics.
Yeah.
To be frank, there's a lot of reasons, but he speaks to me on a personal level in that way, and I really relate it.
Yeah.
When Bendis started talking about Miles Morales.
Yeah.
And a lot of you talk to even at certain shows, you know, you look at cosplayers, they could be anyone underneath there, right?
It's true. I love seeing the Spider-Verse group go around the con. That's awesome.
Yes, yes. And here's another thing. There's one of the all-time best, let's say top 10 Spider-Man stories was by Paul Jenkins and Mark Buckingham.
You're telling me about this.
Yeah, I think we were discussing this on his run of Peter Parker's Spider-Man, I want to say, where it was told from the point of view of an inner city black kid, a very young kid with a trouble who would escape. And who can't relate to that? Someone who grew up around some troubled surroundings would escape into comics. And his imaginary friend was Spider-Man. And I thought the beautiful moment at the end of that was his imaginary friend took off his mask, and the Spider-Man in his head at the end of the story was an African-American male who represented a father figure to this kid who didn't have a father figure. And I found that a very touching and relatable experience that I think a lot of fans can have.
Yeah.
So again, I'll sort of step off my little soapbox about that. Just
no, I love it.
It's been in the culture a lot, and I get it from all sides. You know what I understand. Sometimes a different incarnation of the character doesn't jive with your worldview of this character.
Yeah,
and
but it's serialized storytelling.
Pretty much.
You know,
it's soap opera.
I want to see Spider-Man married. I want to see Peter Parker rich.
Yeah.
I want to see Peter Parker broke. Because I grew up, you know, Superman and Batman were my first introduction to superheroes. So for me, that's where my heart lies.
Yeah.
But I remember, along with those characters, there was a Spider-Man cartoon growing up. And for some reason, I related to that character. And now, as I've gotten older and I've read more and more comics, Spider-Man, people know me as being the Superman guy.
Yeah.
My wife loves Batman.
Yeah.
And Batman's the most relatable because he can get hurt and anyone could be Batman. For me, I find Spider-Man to kind of top them out for me. Because I relate to his emotional problems as well. Not just I'm not going to make the rent, which everyone relates to.
Of course,
you know,
of course.
I have a sick family, which everyone relates to. My wife is mad at me. You know, there's those stories. But then there's that guilt that he carries with him all the time.
It's wonderful motivation as well, right?
Yeah, and I never realized it, but I relate. I don't know why, but that he carries so much guilt with him. And, and a part of me is like that too. It's just this inherent thing I have. But that character has all these emotional things while he's swinging through the city on a sunny day, and he's loving life.
He's
got
to pay the rent.
Yeah.
He's got to pay the rent.
His best day gets, he also gets humanized because he sees there's a newspaper article where, like, oh, they still hate me.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's okay, I can do this. So as much as it sucks, there's so much good still.
Or even, like, struggle. Here's one of the facts. Again, our writers didn't quite know how to write a married Peter Parker, and I can't remember who did it, but...
did you like married Peter Parker?
Sorry? I did too. It depends who, like, you know, there's different stories that work and different stories that don't. Was it David Michelinie?
Yeah.
Who wrote about the... I'm trying to remember which era, but there was an era where there was a discrepancy between their incomes, if I'm remembering correctly.
It was during that era.
Mary Jane was a high-profile model making a lot of money who could easily support
even on a soap opera.
Yeah,
right?
She
was a soap opera actress.
Yeah, but then Peter still had his pride, right? It's like, I'm married to a supermodel, but even in those supposedly unrelatable circumstances, again, whoever was writing Peter at the time, I remember thinking, okay, that's a genuine motivation. It's when there's a shift and you want to stand on your own as your own person and not necessarily be Mr. Mary Jane Watson.
Yeah,
they've managed to milk some, and then there's a lot of difficulties they had over the years. I think it was during was it John Byrne's Spider-Man run where they got rid of Mary Jane for a little while. She just sort of
blew up in a plane or something
like that. I know Paul Jenkins, by the time Paul Jenkins was writing Peter Parker's Spider-Man, he was somehow single, and I can't remember
how they were separated. And during the Straczynski one, she was in California, and he was in New York. Okay.
Gotcha.
I remember him like being tormented at the fact that I just wish she was here, but she doesn't want to talk to me right now.
With that said, I don't think they handled the dissolving of the Spider-Man relationship very well.
That was horrible.
But I think what's really worked is they've brought back the soap opera.
Yeah, they refreshed it. That refresh button led them to some more stories.
Dan Slott's run, and then who else was in that reboot? Mark Waid?
He was there.
Joe Kelly.
Mark Guggenheim.
They all proved that actually the soap opera that had been kind of missing for Spider-Man for a decade or more, I can't remember, like, probably close to, it was coming close to 2 decades of a married Spider-Man, right?
Yeah.
If not 15 years, it
yeah,
was
at least,
close
at
to
least.
20. And such a huge part of Spider-Man was that soap opera. You know, the whole Betty, Veronica, Archie kind of thing. You know, Gwen, Mary Jane, Peter, Mary Jane and Harry, Peter and Mary Jane.
Black Cat.
Yeah. Oh, that wasn't... We both were reading Spider-Man at a young age during that era, right?
Well, I've gone back and read all of that era. So I remember, like, that she loved Spider-Man, but she couldn't handle Peter Parker.
And then Mary Jane came back around that time. But they weren't together. That's what I loved. I really felt like they developed Mary Jane's character outside of a relationship with Peter Parker in that context. And then they even gave her, they retconned a beautiful motivation for her, which is that she's always known Peter Parker. Was it Spider-Man Parallel Lives? That was a graphic novel, right? Where they show them growing up and...
I think so, but I remember the issue where she's walking with Peter through Central Park.
Mm-hmm.
It was DeFalco and Friends.
Okay.
Where it was just after he had gotten the symbiote suit.
Ah.
And she had come back and told him her story about growing up. Like, this is why I always acted kind of flaky, because it was, you know, a defense mechanism for my abusive childhood. Like, it was good stuff.
Oh, yeah, and it's all of a sudden, you know, the party girl has a lot of depth.
Yeah.
I found that to be a great era for the character. And, of course, they rushed the marriage a little bit. I think Stan wanted them married in the comic strip, I think. And then so they sort of... Because they weren't together at the time in the comic book, so they had to hurry up and
come
up with
an
excuse. Because he had already proposed to her years ago, and then she said no, broke up with him, and I think the retcon was the reason why she didn't marry him then was she knew he was Spider-Man.
Oh.
It was like the Aunt May's death, where she always knew added that little retcon of her always knowing that he was Spider-Man or had known for a long time.
Yeah.
But now I'm actually really enjoying the Mary Jane character just running around the Marvel Universe. She's been fantastic as a supporting character, ex-girlfriend of Peter's. But have you been reading Bendis's Iron Man?
No, I didn't.
He's been doing... I think I would like to see more of her on her own.
Yeah.
And as much as I'm always rooting for Peter Parker and Mary Jane to get back together, I think it should be a little bit like...
Will they, won't they?
The sitcom. Yeah. Okay. I think... And they've teased us even recently, I think, in the latest issues that Dan Slott's done just before the end. He sort of teased us with the will they or won't they again. And for as long as they can keep that up, right? While making her a more fully rounded character. Like her running Stark, I don't think they pushed that as far as they could, because there was a lot going on in those Iron Man titles, especially once Doctor Doom and Riri came in. But she had potential. There was definitely a lot of potential. And do you remember the fun storyline where was it the Iron Spider armor?
Yes, that was good. No, I like Dan Slott's run. A lot of people kind of criticized it, but to be able to write it for as long as he did, introduce as many things as he did, and I feel he's in an... Writing Spider-Man is one of the toughest tasks because he's one of those characters who doesn't always get sucked into the big events.
Mm-hmm.
He's got his own big events.
Yes.
So sometimes the editorial and the scheduling of these things to get the train to run on time is not as easy as people think. So he's telling pretty strong stories. Like, I like Spider-Verse a lot. I like even...
Superior Spider-Man was phenomenal.
Yeah, and
so for me, do whatever you want. You know Peter Parker will eventually go, like... I know a lot of people were upset about his Parker Industries stage.
Did you like it?
I did.
I did too.
I did. Again, I didn't think it was the strongest of his run, but still strong.
I mean,
you know what I mean?
What's cool about it is he's still doing Peter Parker stuff. Like,
yes.
He's not suddenly as business savvy as Tony Stark.
Oh, yeah.
He's still
As we learned with the climax of the story, he messes up.
Yeah.
Everyone knew, I think, anyone who's a real sort of hardcore Spider-Man fan going into that storyline knew it would be temporary.
Yeah.
And you could almost tell as the story was going on that Peter being Peter and being distracted and being more concerned with being Spider-Man, Parker Industries would eventually crumble around him and he would be left back at square one
for the new guys.
I'm loving, and then Dan Slott gets to tell one more story with Peter Parker working at the Daily Bugle, and the new status quo is actually quite clever. Him being the science advisor as opposed to he's the science editor now?
I'm not sure. Okay. I'm buying everything in trade right now, reading stuff in chunks.
Gotcha. Spoilers.
No, that's okay.
He's back at the Daily Bugle, but not as a photographer.
Okay.
But it makes perfect sense given his science background, they've been evolving for 20 years now, from the time I think he was a science teacher through to joining Horizon Industries and all that. Like, it's about time. That working for Stark as well. So they've managed to come up with a great reason for him to be back at the Bugle, back to status quo.
Are you looking forward to Nick Spencer and Ryan Otley? I think Ryan Otley's a great choice for it. Because I love Invincible.
Yes.
I don't know if you've read Invincible. I loved Invincible.
I think Otley is the perfect artist. I'm going to take a wait-and-see.
Going
to take a wait-and-see approach. And again, even if it's not my cup of tea, there'll be another bus along in 5-10 minutes.
Yeah, they'll go back to number one at some point.
And again, especially since Peter Parker, starting with the way they've redefined, Chip Zdarsky has redefined the J. Jonah Jameson relationship, and also looks like they're digging into the journalism side of things a little more on that title.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to seeing where sort of the humor and the angst of Jonah and Peter being mismatched buddies.
Yes.
Because, Slott was writing some beautiful stuff where Peter and Jonah were on equal footing because they were now, stepbrothers.
Yeah, right, yeah,
De facto stepbrothers,
yeah, yeah.
And I thought that was wonderful.
Yeah.
I thought that was a wonderful relationship, and it seems like the natural evolution of it's something we've never seen before. And I am I'm actually a very big fan of J. Jonah Jameson. I think he's not only a great foil.
Yes.
He's the best foil for Spider-Man, but over the years, some really good writers, Frank Miller, the way he wrote Jonah, supervising Ben Urich in Daredevil showed a lot of the other side of Jonah, the newspaper man.
It's true, yeah.
And there's also a series that no one's ever heard of, no one's ever read that I know of. It's called The Daily Bugle. There were 3 issues during the 90s when 100 Spider-Man titles were being pumped out. For some inexplicable reason, it was a black and white comic. It was written by Paul Grist, who does one of my favorite crime comics called Kane, K-A-N-E. Any fan of police procedural and crime mafia comics should check that out. But he did a wonderful... Peter Parker was a character in it, but he never came in as Spider-Man.
So it's kind of like a Gotham Central take?
It was. It was way before its... It was ahead of its time. If you can track it down, three issues. It featured Jonah getting back to his roots as a journalist. Betty Brant also chasing a story. And I think there might have been a third character that I'm forgetting about, but and Peter Parker supporting in a supporting role. And
I like when the camera, you know, goes on the other side and yes. shows the inner workings of that person's world in a little bit more depth, because it just adds so much more layers to his world. That
And journalism is a in this day and age especially.
Yeah,
I know Bendis has said he's going to explore that with the Daily Planet.
How do you think he'll do with Superman?
I'm going to wait and see. But again, what excites me is more than his Superman title, the way he's described Action Comics is going to be more about Metropolis.
Yeah.
And the supporting cast in the newspaper. And I think that's where he's going to excel.
Do you think...
All eyes are on Superman, but I'm going to look over at Action Comics.
Yeah.
And as we were saying, I think the best writers really do well with the supporting cast.
Do you think Superman's as hard to write as everyone makes it out
yes.
to be? Really?
I think he is. He's a tough character to get. And
okay, so why would people write Thor? Do you think Thor is a tough character to crack? He's basically Superman, but
in
literally
some ways,
a god.
But the wonderful thing is, as Simonson, well, look at Simonson. He delved into a lot of, with his own contemporary take, he delved into the mythology.
Right.
He went back to basics. Right. And I think there's a wealth of material in there. And also we're at that point, as we've seen with Jason Aaron's extended run. Again, he's tough to write, but I think if you dig into the source material, there's a great supporting cast in there.
That's the thing.
Jane Foster... her arc has been fantastic. Again, I have been enjoying her version of Thor. I've been enjoying her motivation. I think she's a throwback to the earliest days of Marvel Comics, where all the heroes were dealing with ailments of some sort. Like, she was sort of in their personal lives, they're behind the eight ball.
Mm-hmm.
And having Jane Foster dying of cancer, spoilers for those that
yeah,
are...
Yeah, I think everyone knows that if they go to the
And the fact that turning into Thor undoes her chemotherapy every single time.
Yeah.
And so every time she's heroic, she's sacrificing more of her life. Really compelling.
Yeah, very.
And also, he'd already set up some really great... Jason Aaron, that is, set up some great... things in his run of Thor, where you were flashing back to the future of Thor and the past of Thor. I don't know if you were reading Jason Aaron's title.
Yeah, I love that.
I thought he set up some brilliant things.
The God Butcher stuff.
Yeah. So there's all these wonderful dominoes, and then you have Jane Foster, whom he set up beautifully in that initial run. So her stepping in was a natural story progression that I think was fantastic.
Yeah, it wasn't a stunt.
No, that's for
sure. A lot
sure.
of people, there's a lot of stuff that they do that are big stunts or
and
event
And even if
driven,
it is a stunt, as long as it's done well, I'm always willing. And then, as we already know, Thor number one's coming out, as predicted. Odin's son,
returns.
Thor, it returns in time for...
Avengers
you know,
Infinity.
Yeah. But in the meantime, we have a great chunk of storyline that I know I'll go back and reread a lot carefully now that it's complete.
Yeah.
Because there's so many layered things that are happening. Especially with the at the end of the day, the world around you should be what you're writing about, right? So in a lot of ways, there was a lot of thinly disguised politics in Thor. Again, some of it was a little heavy-handed, but I did enjoy them trying to bring democracy to the Nine Realms. I thought that sort of background story made a really rich tapestry.
Yeah.
Oklahoma was an interesting idea. J. Michael Straczynski's run on Thor was an interesting idea that I don't think was executed to its full potential. I don't think they stuck the landing on that one. As much as I like the idea, as long as you can find your in.
Yeah.
And I think from all the interviews, Bendis has found his in. Like I said, I'm going to be looking at Action Comics more than Superman, because that seems to be the stuff.
He's writing both, right?
He's writing both and has said that he's dealing more with Metropolis and the characters in Metropolis and the newspaper in the pages of, if Action. I'm remembering correctly.
Okay.
In the same way that I wish there would be a revival of this daily, especially now with the status quo being. Now would be the perfect time for Marvel to take a chance and revive the Daily Bugle as, and they kind of did. The Pulse was an interesting experiment in a Daily Bugle type title where Ben Urich and Jessica Jones.
I would have liked to see Ben Urich in the Jessica Jones TV show.
I would have as well.
Now that you say that.
And I understand why they did it, the way they did on the Netflix universe.
Yeah.
It gave, again, spoilers, it gave Karen a lot more to do than simply die to further Matt's cause or become a junkie or a prostitute, porn star. I understand why they did it, and she's become such a rich character as a result of becoming Ben Urich in the Netflix universe that she even shows up in The Punisher standing on her own. So it's a shame they had to do away with Ben Urich. It would be great if I would love to see him back. He was a fantastic actor.
Yeah.
And he did a great job with the character, but I understand why they did it, and we've got a richer richer Karen Page as a result.
Yeah.
As we jump around all over
that's
the place.
That's okay. I love it. No,
with
I love
our
it.
Conversation. But my pitch out there is that Marvel should do a Daily Bugle series, just like Gotham Central, dealing with the Bugle cast. Peter Parker can be part of the cast in Spider-Man peripherally.
Yeah.
But let's get Betty Brant is a fantastic character. I think what was it? Did you read the most recent Amazing? You haven't read the most recent Amazing Spider-Man manual. It was a wonderful Jonah and Betty. Slott wrote a great Betty Brant Jonah story that should be an ongoing series.
Yeah,
in my opinion.
Especially, that's a great idea, actually, I think.
Especially as status is in comics writing, just to bring this back to... And again, we haven't been talking specifically about my creative process, but I think you're getting an idea of how I creatively approach things by the way I describe other media. But, status... And this was a big part I learned in Ty Templeton's comic book bootcamp. But the status of a character and their relationships with each other and the shifting dynamic of that status is a wonderful thing to play with. And
there's so many different...
And we've seen Jonah, in the publisher's seat, but... The few times I've seen him pounding the pavement as a journalist, and now that he's blogging on his own, he's a low-status character.
Yes.
And you've never seen him as low as that My Dinner with Jonah, Peter Parker. And I think that's... And then here's a character with a lot of hubris, a lot of ego, who has been humbled...
And you can explore why they're like that,
oh,
right?
Yeah.
That's the beauty of it.
And that's what they did through a conversation. And here's the thing. It breaks all the rules, right? My Dinner with Andre, a famous movie, breaks all the rules in that it's an entire movie with two people like you and I sitting here over dinner having a conversation. The same thing. That one issue of Spider-Man was Peter Parker and Jonah sitting at a table relating to each other and exploring their past and laying their issues with each other on the table. Mm-hmm. And sorry, I should correct myself. It was actually Spider-Man that Jonah had dinner with.
Oh, wow.
But then there was a twist at the end that changed their status forever. And this would be a great thing to explore. More Betty, more Joe Robertson.
Yeah.
Has always been wonderfully written. We were talking about the Tombstone relationship and the story where Joe Robinson is in jail.
Yeah.
With Tombstone being a great...
Those are my favorite moments. It's not... Like, I love the action, the bam pow, all of that stuff is great.
I think it's part and parcel. This is us as adult readers, too. So,
yeah, but that like, I guess, as a kid, looking at the pictures, I used to love... I hated when I bought a Superman comic off the rack that Superman was only in a few pages. I wanted to see the mm-hmm. books where he was just flying and fighting.
Yeah.
But now when I go back and read some of that stuff, I love the relationship he had with, like, Cat Grant.
Yeah.
Clark Kent and Cat Grant, or him and Lois. And, yeah. And it, because it's all the character building there.
Of course. Well, I think on the war, I was a member of the Warren Ellis forum for ages and ages, and I think term... you just posted there. It was a huge gathering place.
That's where Bendis was on that forum.
Bendis
right?
was on and, Fraction and Kelly Sue were
that's
on.
Right.
Like, who's who were on that forum
yeah.
talking about it. A lot of them before they entered
yeah.
comics. But I'm trying to remember. It might have been Fraction or someone who coined the term Kicksplode. And I think this is a necessary part of mainstream comics. The kicking and the explosions, that moment of, you know, boom.
Right.
That's dynamic and whatever, but and all mainstream needs kicksplode, but to balance it out, let's have the character moments,
that's,
right?
That's where the richness comes from.
Yeah, yeah.
So let's talk about some of the things that you're working on.
Yeah,
what are
sure.
some of the books that you're in the process of making, or things that you've recently done where people can look at?
Sure, sure. We've just come out with the third issue of a series called Victorian Four. They're a steampunk superhero team set in the Victorian era. Sort of imagine Sherlock Holmes, one of my favorite characters, trapped in the body of the Frankenstein monster. Lincoln survives assassination with a transfusion of vampire blood. Madame Curie, who in real life discovered radiation, basically turns into the Hulk. She's Mrs. Hyde, we call her, and they're led by John Henry, the sort of American folk hero who built the railroads. And he's the leader of the team, and essentially they're fighting an alien invasion and a secret clandestine conspiracy. I'll have to note, Sherlock Frankenstein is a recent comic from Jeff Lemire, and our character predates that comic by about 5 years. So I'd have to say it's an interesting how idea space works. In no way am I implying that, you know, he ever saw our indie comic.
Yeah.
But I'm sure he was tapping into the same idea space that the rest of us are often tapping into with that. I just was kind of amused when that title was sort of announced, because we had done the same thing. But here's the great thing about ideas. People are always afraid of having their ideas stolen, especially folks that are, I guess, more wannabe writers rather than actual writers, I'd like to say. You can have the same idea, but there's a million different ways to execute that idea. So,
and no story is going to have the same path.
Yeah, yeah. And again, I it's on my reading list. I'm sure that Sherlock Frankenstein is miles away from what I've done with my version of the character. And I think it's hilarious that, the same, like it's, well, I was going to cite Swamp Thing and Man Thing as two completely different executions of the same idea.
Yeah.
But there is a little bit of connectivity in there, in that we're not quite sure. Both the writers of them claim they came up with it independently, and there's a lineage because both characters are based on the Golden Age character, the Heap.
Okay.
That appeared in Airboy Comics, which was a swamp monster who was a World War II pilot. but both writers were also roommates at the time.
Who, I know Len Wein created Swamp Thing.
Yes, and, God, we should, you know what, I'm gonna...
Was it not Marv Wolfman? Because I know they were, like, best friends growing up.
Yeah, yeah. There's a great book that I'm reading right now from Two Morrows. It's called, I think, Swamp Men. And it's all about swamp creatures in comics. Just because I am a big Swamp Thing fan, but I'm also a big Man Thing fan, and I'm aware of sort of the lineage of swamp creatures. But who created Man Thing? This is the great thing. We can always look it up, right?
You can always look it up. Not Steve Gerber.
They say it's created by Stan Lee, Roy Thomas, and Jerry Conway. And I want to say, if my memory serves, and again, this would have been a great question when you interviewed Jerry Conway. I think he was roommates with Len Wein at the time.
Yeah, they were all they were all at Marvel at the same
time.
Kind of like trying to pass the baton of who the editor was going to be.
Well, the other thing I remember is they also, all these guys used to do unofficial crossovers.
Yeah.
So that the Avengers, analogs of the Avengers would show up in the Justice League, and then analogs of the Justice League would show up in the Avengers, and there'd be sort of unofficial crossover. So that's probably where, again, if I'm remembering correctly, I say this a lot because...
I think you are, because your memory's pretty good.
Okay.
You said before
that Squadron Supreme. Yes. You know Squadron Supreme?
Yes.
I think they came out of one of these unofficial crossovers.
Yes.
And there's also a similar, not as popular DC team who eventually became members of Giffen's Justice League. I think there was Blue Jay and Silver Sorceress and a Thor analog that showed up in these early episodes
Avengers.
As the analog Avengers in these unofficial crossovers.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. But they were doing a lot of fun stuff back then. Like, just because, you know, they were all in Manhattan. They were all young. They were all coming up as fans turned professional.
That was a great era of comic books because it was those kids who weren't ashamed to be comic book writers. Whereas that first era were all like, it was almost as though they were embarrassed, or it's like we never made it in life, so we have to become comic book writers instead of real prose writers.
Well,
right?
What's the story about Stan Lee? The reason why he, again, this might be urban legend, but wasn't it he was saving his real name for the great American novel?
Yeah, that you're not wrong.
And
he said that.
He did, and he was using Stan Lee as his pseudonym in comics so that he wouldn't, you know. Him being let's face it, comics were disposable.
Yeah.
They weren't collected.
For a long
time. They came on the newsstands, they went away, so Stan Lee was his pseudonym because it was disposable entertainment, and then when he wrote the great American novel, he would be Stan Lee Lieberman, right?
Yes, that's right.
So that's, it's funny how life works.
It's so funny now when you look back at what they were creating in that decade, him and Kirby and Ditko, and now when you see everything that we're consuming as a culture,
we can't
escape it. You know,
no, it's true. It's
the
true.
Movies, the Netflix, the comics, the TV. It's such a great time to be a fan of those. So you no longer have to be embarrassed.
Of course, of course. But yeah, after our little digression, I'm very proud of Victorian Four right now. The artist is Matthew Tavares, who has been doing some amazing work on the title. And again,
you've collaborated with him quite frequently, right?
Yes, he's a frequent collaborator. Both of us came up together, and again, this is the true of a lot of my frequent collaborators. We came up together at Ty Templeton's Comic Book Boot Camp, and I think the reason why I tend to have a lot of frequent collaborators that were with me at Boot Camp was we kind of have a shortcut as well, because we speak the same language that we learned in class. There's a wonderful rapport where essentially I can, there's shortcuts. You know, we know that a wide shot is, when I say wide, I don't have to explain what my intention with a wide shot is, which is establishing information shot. You know, a medium shot, a medium panel is an action panel, and then a close-up is emotional. And so you've got shortcuts, essentially. And also the other thing is, because I think visually, I think all writers, if they're in the Toronto area, definitely take Ty's writing for comics class. If you're a would-be comics writer, you just get all the life hacks in terms of things you don't have to learn the hard way. Sometimes you have to learn them the hard way, but by the end of the course, you've got a script that works. But not only should you take the writing class, you should take the layout class. I'm very fortunate in that my original intention was to write and draw my own things, and I do tend to think visually. So often, here's another reason why I probably have a lot of frequent collaborators is that I think in terms of panels and breakdowns and storytelling. So often I'm told by artists I work with that they'll get a script which is written in screenplay format.
Yeah.
You know, often amateur writers will write in screenplay format as opposed to comics panels, which is a still image. So it's full of dialogue that couldn't possibly fit within the confines of the story. The other thing is you tend to get screen direction in a lot of scripts that they're handed as opposed to panel description. So what I mean by screen direction is an artist will get a panel that says so-and-so punches them and jumps out the window.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, that's not one panel.
Yeah.
So if you're thinking visually, you've got to break it down into here's the wide establishing where they are, here's the medium establishing action, here's the close-up establishing what they're feeling in this situation.
I hear so many good things about Ty Templeton's boot camp.
Well, here's another thing. I had no intention, really, of being a comics creator. I was very comfortable in the corporate world with my job. I was very comfortable as a fan. But at the same time, I guess I was kind of unhappy with putting on a tie. And other than my commute, where I got to read comics.
What did you do in the
corporate world? I was very fortunate. I went into university taking fine art and then also film studies. But something... While I was at school, there was a new field called interactive media.
Okay.
That was so I went into university, basically exited university, having the film department that I was at was given all this multimedia equipment. I'm doing finger quotes again. This means Apple laptops, digital software, digital media. Programming software where you could create, for example, interactive movies or games or things like that. So it was the early days of what we called multimedia, interactive media, the early internet was also a part of that. So I came out of school with the skills, I guess, for a job that didn't exist when I went into school. So I was very, very fortunate to get in on that. I was a project manager who did... I built virtual walkthroughs for kiosks in home sale centers. I did laptop presentations for doctors. I built... I branded and built the skins on online casinos. So yeah, a lot of freelance work. I was also in on the ground floor of what we call the dot-com era. So I, at a very young age, I found myself fairly successful in a brand new a hot new field.
Before it became something that everybody was getting into.
Yeah, and was there at a very exciting time. But again, you were overwhelmed by corporate interests. So there's a lot of what I did was marketing. So in terms of what I did, it was essentially interactive marketing. But I'd come home often and I was kind of unhappy, and then for fun. But I was involved in fandom. Like I said, I was in the Warren Ellis forum at a very early days, and actually got to meet a lot of creators in and around Toronto at that time. And it was sort of the who's who of the folks around there at the time. You'd go out and have meetups, and you'd have drinks. But again, I never thought I'd want to create comics. I had a career already.
Yeah, you were in the community of those that were creatives, but you had your own successful career.
But I had the good fortune of, for fun, I thought, you know what? Here's a little background about growing up in Toronto as well. As a very young kid, I discovered, not only discovered sort of that downtown scene, but in Silver Snail, there were always flyers for these little Comic-Cons. Little one-day, you know, dinky rooms full of dealers and occasional guests and all the local comics creators in the city at that time. So at, I think it was, I want to say, one of my very first con experiences as a kid, I got to go to OCA, and I met a gentleman there, a young man named Ty Templeton, who was sitting behind his table, and I saw, you know, his artwork, and it looked just like Mad Magazine. And we're talking early Mad Magazine, 1950s, Harvey Kurtzman, Will Elder, Wally Wood style Mad Magazines that you had to read as paperbacks. And he was really nice to me. You know, especially since I was obviously a fan of those old Mad paperbacks that reprinted the 1950s stories. And at the time, he was doing a book called Stig's Inferno. And I think he was likely still a student at OCA at the time. And I became a fan after that. I picked up his comic, Stig's Inferno, because the artwork looked like early Wally Wood and had a lot of early Mad Magazine influence. And then years later, I learned that Ty was teaching these classes. So I took these classes. I'd come home happy. And one day I decided we were doing, Ty had, I guess, a class that was a bit of an apprenticeship. He's not running it anymore, which is a shame, but students under his editorial guidance would create a comic called Holmes Inc., about the descendants of Sherlock Holmes. And again, me being a huge Sherlock Holmes fan, this was great. So I, after taking all his classes, I also took this course. And it's kind of amazing some of the folks that came out who worked on those early Holmes Inc. Gibson Quarter, I think you know. Excuse me, Adam Gorham.
Yeah.
I think Jason Edmonston did one of the covers, if I'm remembering correctly. And a lot of, as well, Matthew Tavares, Christopher Yao are both frequent collaborators of mine. And that was because we all sort of came up together as peers. But that was another revelation, because there's the theoretical aspect of creating comics, but Ty, basically, under his editorial guidance, took you through all the steps to create your own comic. And all of a sudden, that door opened up to me. I don't know if you've heard about the early days of what was called Comic Book Lounge.
Kevin Boyd. Yeah.
Owned by Kevin Boyd. So, that did you ever visit that space? Early on, that space was sort of three... it was the Toronto Cartoonist Workshop, okay, where I was taking classes with Ty Templeton, Leonard Kirk, Dave Ross. I think other people teaching there included Eric Kim. I got to work on an issue of Cerebus Low Society at the Toronto Cartoonist Workshop, as well under the editorial guidance of Rob Walton, the creator of Ragmop, who's another local creator with some history in town. But from that apprenticeship, shall we say, at Holmes Inc., there were a few of us who really enjoyed that experience and opted to start up a studio.
Yeah, that's right.
So,
tell us about that studio.
It was called. It is. It's still called Comic Book Embassy, and it's still there on Spadina right now. But about three or four of us got together, decided to form a studio, found the space on Spadina, and lo and behold, the Cartoonist Workshop was sort of dissolving at that point out of the Comic Book Lounge space. So Ty was looking to get out on his own, and then moved in with us. So the front of Comic Book Embassy is Comic Book Bootcamp, where the classroom is, and then the back was a studio, and that was a wonderful 2 years that I spent in the studio with some of my other Holmes Inc. alumni, and there's nothing
quite
about
the pedigree of like people to be around and to learn and
associate
with regularly.
Of course, and a lot of them are making quite good names for themselves in the comics industry right now. But the great thing was even just having Ty in the front room, like you could still continue to take classes or just interact with Ty when he came in to teach his class and check out what we were doing. And also there's nothing like the energy of working with people in the same studio space. It's just this unspoken creative energy that forces you to, it's harder, I'm experiencing this now at home, it's harder to knuckle down and get it done.
Yeah.
When
especially
there's
when
not
your pile of books that you want to read is so high.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, the great thing is you can always create virtual studio spaces. Often my studio spaces are restaurants like this, or coffee shops where me and my collaborators will come. Like, it's one thing to pass scripts back and forth, but it's another where Matthew Tavares or recently Jason Tosiewicz is another collaborator of mine. We literally sit across from each other. I'm typing away. Sometimes we're working on the same thing. Sometimes we're working on different things. But at, you know, certain moments, Matt or Jason or Chris will slide over a drawing after I've sort of turned my laptop and said, what do you think of this outline? And so there's an actual old-style Marvel bullpen approach as opposed to what the reality is, which is more assembly line.
You need that, though. I find when you... The best inspiration is not when you're sitting by yourself. It's you someone's idea sparks your idea and vice versa, and then you realize, oh, now I can make my thing better because you said that.
Yeah.
Which is good.
I've got a space offer comedy called Zip Kramer, and my artist on that is Marvin Law. Mm-hmm. And poor Marvin waits a long time for scripts sometimes. And I've discovered that actually part of a good process now is because sometimes you just sit there and you sort of agonize and you work in a lonely silo versus, hey, how about I get my collaborator and business partners, because we co-own these properties we create, get their input as co-creators in earlier. So often it's like instead of writing the script, and you discover a lot about the characters writing the script, but why don't we start with a character description? And that's not necessarily the final character you come up with.
Yeah.
But you slide that over to your collaborator, and all of a sudden, as I'm struggling with the script, Marvin, for example, will slide over, four character designs. Or he'll slide over, this is what the setting looks like. You've described this alien frontier with these buildings, here, and then a light goes off in your head, right? And it's like, and then that creative feedback loop, I like to call it, it's at that point where you're not quite sure where the writer begins and the artist, you know, begins in terms of
marriage.
The creative.
Yeah,
yeah, it is. It is more than anything. You've really got to, and again, I think it helps that I'm kind of, I don't necessarily describe myself as a comic artist, but sometimes I'm a cartoonist. You've seen my work. It's a very cartoony kind of style. And I tend to think visually, so that always helps in that sort of creativity. And also, a lot of my collaborators on their own like to write their own stuff. And sometimes I'll, they'll hand me what they're writing, and I'll read it over and give notes and give encouragement, and they go off and they're working on their own book as well. So I think it's a wonderful feedback loop and a wonderful support system you have. Like, these are all the people that are going to come up with you in the industry, and I think there needs to be more of that. You can't look at this as competition, you know, because to me, the ship raises all... the tide raises all ships.
Yeah.
You know, there's enough...
That's what the podcasters in the local area say, you know, like, you're... We're repping the Fastball Special here tonight. You got the t-shirt on.
I've got the t-shirt. I actually forgot that I had somehow entered a contest. I think Shane was like, hey, he's looking for some suggestions. And I typed up a bunch, not realizing it was a contest. And one day Martin shows up with this t-shirt. And I'm like, another day where I don't have to do laundry. So I will. This is now in the rotation of one extra day where I don't have to do laundry. But
the community of it all is nice to see. You know, you listen to another podcaster's podcast, you find out about an artist or a writer that you've never heard before, and it just becomes like this really nice community where everyone's lifting each other up to create things.
And I think the other indication of this is the wealth of anthologies, where everyone is working together to do their best work and contribute to things like Toronto Comics or Hogtown Horror or Monstrosity. It's a who's who of the Toronto scene. Strange Romance is another one. Like, they're just cropping up all over the place. Wayward Sisters just came out as a Toronto Comics spin-off, which is an amazing book. I recommend everyone pick that one up. It's kind of a wonderful community, and also the cross-pollination as well of, hey, here's an anthology, and I've never worked with this person before. Let's do 5 pages together, and then you find, hey, we've got a really great rapport. Yeah. And then, you know, next thing you know, it can start as 2 pages or 1 pages too, but, you know, 1 or 2 pages can become 5 pages, which can become 12 pages, which can become a full 22-page issue, which can become a full 60 to 100-page graphic novel.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, fantastic. There's a true creative energy when you're out there creating with friends in a collaborative setting. And I think too many people creatively get stalled, especially writers, when they're not open to the possibility of shifting their script to suit the artist. And this is one thing I've discovered, and I think this is a Neil Gaiman thing. I'm at that point where I never really write anything without knowing who the artist is. I will go out, study their work, talk to them, like just like here. We're out for dinner, or we're out for coffee, we're at a convention, we're having drinks, and it's like, hey, what have you always wanted to do? What do you want to do? What do you like to do? Christopher Yao, for example, being a very close friend of mine, wants to do superheroes. And to be honest, I had never sort of considered doing superheroes before. As much as I love them, I didn't feel like I had it in me to do straight up superheroes. But we've managed to sort of find a take that worked for me with Major North. That also hopefully works for Chris, says he gets to draw the action-packed superhero scenes he wants, and knowing in my mind that if you have Chris Yao as your artist, you don't waste time with him doing talking heads necessarily, you know, or if he is doing talking heads, make it interesting, give him, you know, emotional cues or relatable, let's say, acting cues for the characters to get across.
Yeah.
Don't write him a screenplay, essentially.
Right.
Don't take your existing screenplay and hand it to him. Give him something visually challenging. Chris always says, too, it's like, oh, write anything for me. But I think it really helps that you have that rapport and partnership and trust as well. So I'm very comfortable writing superhero, particularly a patriotic superhero. Major North is a patriotic superhero in a crowded world of patriotic superheroes where I feel like we've come up with a very unique take.
What's the take?
Essentially, just to rewind the story a little bit, at the Toronto Cartoonist Workshop, I mentioned I had worked on Cerebus. Originally, they had licensed Captain Canuck.
Right.
And the before the recent revival by Chapter House Comics, Captain Canuck was going to be a class project. And so I wrote sort of an outline of a Captain Canuck story, having been a fan as a kid. But, you know, in terms of how would you modernize Captain Canuck, or how would I write Captain Canuck? And at the end of the day, anytime you write a patriotic superhero, I feel like you have to write about how you feel about your country. You have to be sort of the... How do you filter the concept of Canada through you? So the early sort of draft I had done before the class started, and the class was eventually replaced by Cerebus, which is a whole other story. But I had come out with an outline, and then Toronto Comics came along, and I dusted out this outline, handed it to Chris, wrote the script on the basis that the Canadian identity is very fluid. It's also very multicultural. I grew up in, you know, Trudeau's vision, Trudeau Senior, I should say, he had a very unique, and all those early guys, Pearson, etc., had a vision for Canada as they saw themselves being torn apart by English-Francophone relations. You remember what a tumult, I don't know if you probably didn't live through this, but
no.
This is slightly before my time, but English-French relations got really scary, right? And Canada had a really good immigration policy because they needed immigrants to help build our nation. We have a lot of space, a lot of resources. We need a lot of professionals, which, again, is how my dad got into this country and my mom got...
Same with my family.
Yeah, as engineers and physiotherapists, you know. If... I once again say, if I recall correctly, if my history is accurate, following the declaration of the equal, you know, French and English being equal, the folks who saw the and had to come up with a solution for the English-French turmoil foresaw another problem. It's like, okay, now we've got these two, but we're also a nation of immigrants, and we're also increasingly a multicultural society. From all over the world, people are coming to Canada. But we're not a melting pot. We're a patchwork. We're a quilt of different cultures. And you see this in Toronto, don't you?
Yeah.
You grew up in Toronto. You walk around Toronto. Little India, little Portugal, little Vietnam.
True.
Five different Chinatowns in the GTA.
And we all kind of... It seems that people all want to stay in their pocket in some way, whether they realize it or not.
Yeah. Well, this is going to happen.
Yes.
You'll stay in your pocket in the first generation, but the second generation, like me, will start to, shall we say, mix, intermingle, interact, become part of the multiculture, and we're all going to... Here's a very, I guess, optimistic view of Canada. We're very fortunate. We are ridiculously fortunate. We're not perfect. We have racial tension. We have cultural tensions. But in the grand scheme of things, doesn't it feel like to you, as someone who lives in Toronto, everybody more or less gets along?
Yeah.
In a way that you wish the rest of the world would get along.
Yeah, we don't... I was, you know, in talking to one of my friends, people from Toronto don't really understand the nuances of racial strife that happens in the States because it's just not here.
Yeah. Not that it doesn't happen.
It happens.
But, like, we have our own version of Black Lives Matter.
We do. But it's not like the States.
Yes.
You're right.
Yes.
We tolerate each other much more.
And also, it's written into our Constitution.
Yeah.
As I was saying, we are the only country in the world where multiculturalism is written into the Constitution because of visionaries at the time who said, rather than run, like, 10 years, 20 years, 30 years later, rather than run into this multiple times with, you know, all the other cultures that comprise Canada, let's celebrate multiculturalism. Let's write this into our Constitution. Let's eat each other's food. Let's go to each other's restaurants. Let's dance each other's cultural dances. Let's, you know, practice each other's martial arts. And again, this is a very optimistic view, and the world isn't always that as optimistic as your world. But it's like Superman, right?
Yeah.
You have to dream. You have to have a vision.
You have to
see a world, and hopefully Canada being an example of people who are hugely different, who, in general, again, I'm generalizing, live as neighbors with each other, with tension, with everyday tension, everyday conflicts that you might have with your neighbor in terms of how they put their garbage cans or whatever.
Yeah.
But on the whole, we get along.
Yeah.
We get along. We go out and we celebrate each other's cuisine. Toronto, to me, is the best place in the world to have fusion cuisine, right?
I agree.
You go to Kensington Market, and I love the fact that you can go to have Rasta pasta. Or there's another place called the Hungry Thai, where I guess a gentleman of Hungarian origins married a woman of Thai origins, and her and her Hungarian mother-in-law have a menu where you can have Wiener Schnitzel with a side of pad thai.
Mm-hmm.
Or for appetizers, you have fresh rice rolls, spring rolls, along with cabbage rolls.
Right.
And that, to me, is what I would sort of... So that was the intention when I came in and wrote Major North. There's so many patriotic superheroes, especially now.
Yeah.
Again, I was a fan of Captain Canuck. I was also a fan of a comic in the 80s, which I also compare in that wave of revisionist superheroes that included The Shadow and Watchmen. It was called Northgard. And
they're writing Northgard.
They revived them, and it's a crime that the original series isn't back in print, because... The two gentlemen that worked on that series came up with a very unique take on revision. So as much as Northgard, you can call, some people from a visual point of view in the 80s said, oh, Northgard's just knockoff of Captain Canuck. But no, the creative team had a very specific 80s vision. And it also dealt with English-French relations as well, because there was a character called Fleur de Lis, and the writer of that is an Anglais who lives in, sorry as I slaughter French, who lived at the time in Montreal, and the artist was French Quebecois. So I thought there was a very interesting subtext to that original run of Northgard. And more than Captain Canuck being an influence, I cite Northgard as being an influence about how I would go and approach my own vision of Canada. So you have a superhero character that exists in a multicultural Toronto, but also he's the supernatural embodiment of the Canadian cultural identity. How do you define that?
Yeah.
You can't.
No, you can't.
It's a constant struggle. So essentially, here's someone who has native origins, is the other part of his backstory that we're going to be telling. We haven't quite revealed the full extent of this, but he has a Métis background, but he's been wiped clean, basically. When he gained the powers being the supernatural embodiment of the Canadian cultural identity, whatever that might be, it sort of supplanted what was there before and replaced it with, you know, dueling voices in his head. So some of the things that we're sort of dealing with in terms of trying to find our unique take on a superhero is not only is he a reluctant, patriotic superhero, he's dealing with what the outside perceives as mental illness, and there's an element of him also being homeless that, again, we've only hinted at in the first issue, and we'll be exploring in much more depth, particularly when it comes to, there was a fantastic CBC, coincidentally, it's something we sort of deal with in the next script that I've written, where we have a bit of a revisionist take on Canada and what happened with, let's say, with the Red River Rebellion. And there was a CBC show recently where they put Sir John A. Macdonald on trial for, you know, as an academic exercise, for crimes against humanity, for what he inflicted on the Red River settlement, the Métis culture there that at the time, of course, wasn't seen as its own unique culture as it is today.
Yeah.
But it's sort of exactly what I was, coincidentally, again, this was, I think, last night as I was driving, I was like, wow, again, this is idea space, right?
Yeah.
I've happened to have written this into my script, and now I'm going to run, when it comes time to, you know, write the dialogue and stuff into the artwork, I have a wealth of new material to insert, because basically Major North's American, or sorry, imaginary friends, the voices in his head and the people that appear to him, are icons of Canada, avatars of Canada. So sometimes he'll... Is it Chris Hadfield, the astronaut? For example, will appear to him. Terry Fox will appear to him. There's a cartoon beaver, which will become his Harvey, his imaginary sidekick that I've delighted in writing with. So from what originally was a very traditional superhero, I think I found my unique take.
That sounds very
on it. Our mutual friend Jason Clark, who does the Elegant Weapon podcast, likes to... All my scripts, he's cited, always have sort of a moment of weirdness that sort of shakes you up a little bit. And so I, you know, and again, it was never anything I probably did consciously, but now that it's been pointed out to me, I can't help but sort of see these in my scripts. And this includes my kids' scripts as well.
Yeah.
And apparently especially includes my kids' scripts, where there's a moment where, because your worldview is a little tilted, you know, you're introducing through your art, through your writing, a little bit of that tilted worldview. You're putting yourself into the story, and I very much had a moment of glee when, you know, for example, I Hogtown Horror. Have you read the anthology Hogtown Horror?
No.
It a couple of the original editors for Toronto Comics spun off a horror story, and remind me to send you a copy of this, or I'll give you a copy of Dwayne's Inferno, again with frequent collaborator Chris Yao, that has a bit of a twist ending.
Okay.
It's essentially about a haunting.
Okay.
And it's about a boy who is seemingly haunted, but I'll say the opposite is true. And not in the Others or Sixth Sense kind of way. I think I found a very different take. And then the biggest compliment I got was Jason Clark just posting about it on the internet. The twist in the story, going, holy mackerel, this is disturbing as hell. What are you on? And in our conversation with that, I had to credit my editor Nelson. at Hogtown Horror. Basically, typically a lot of my stuff is this sort of action comedy horror blend, or sorry, action comedy blend, sometimes with monsters, sometimes with superheroes, and I delivered three pitches, essentially, with the intention of Chris drawing them, and this was in Chris and I, our comfort zone. Chris and I drawing action comedy is pretty much in the wheelhouse. And Nelson said, he handed them back and said, hey, you know, I know what you can write, I know what you're capable of, this is great, but why don't you disturb us? So, yeah, we basically picked up the gauntlet, and as well, here's what helps, here's a little insight into working with an artist. There would be a lot of detailed, repetitive backgrounds. I almost compare it to Cerebus. I don't know if you've seen Gerhard's background art for that, but I decided to pull out a whole new, different bag of tricks, and setting it in a haunted house... And giving Chris sort of the vision of it, I wrote this house as the house he was living in at the time.
Oh, wow.
Having hung out with him at in his home, I thought it was the perfect setting. And again, he'd have to either redraw or clone this house. And what better way than to draw your home? And I think as a result, he really delivered something special. Like, as an environment, you know, a single environment, it...
Especially if you're familiar with it.
It really, really turned out well. And Chris also was, like, jokingly cursing me sometimes, because it's like, I'm here by myself.
Yeah.
And I'm looking over my shoulder in case there's
a world that you're scared of.
A creature that's hovering above me. But... Yeah, this is the other thing. I love a challenge as well. So we all sort of default into our comfort zones. And I never realized that action comedy was kind of my comfort zone.
Yeah.
Before I started the creative process, I always sort of saw myself as a crime noir writer. Like, I wanted to write about, you know, morally gray and bad men in morally gray, you know, black and white setting. You know, something like Touch of Evil, or the stuff that Ed Brubaker. Yeah.
Okay.
More in sort of the Ed Brubaker vein, or I cite Kane, Paul Grist Kane as something I'm a huge fan of, or even the stuff by Max Allen Collins.
Yes,
his Road stuff is the Perdition series is amazing. Both the novels and the graphic novels are. Have you seen the movie, by the way?
Yeah.
Shouldn't Tom Hanks have been played by Gabriel Byrne? As Irish gangsters go, I love Tom Hanks.
To
me, it was Sam Mendes did a beautiful job in this movie, but I needed more of an Irish gangster in that role.
Right.
It needed less of an everyman and more of an edgy kind of morally gray character. But it's weird. As I sort of walk around and look at my influences, that always was sort of... what I thought I should have wrote, but again, because you end up talking to artists and saying, hey, what do you want to draw, or what do you want to write, or editors who say, we need this kind of thing, I've actually tended to have a much more diverse range of material, from numerous kids' books to sci-fi space opera to superheroes to out-and-out horror to True Life. I don't know if you've read the Toronto Comics anthology.
No,
okay, I have a couple of... It's the autobiography of another of my frequent collaborators, Gwen Howarth, who came out a couple of years ago as a trans woman. So we had originally been collaborating on her comic book Omega Zone. And this is actually how I became a writer more than an artist. I entered the studio wanting to write and draw my own stuff. But one day, I'm digressing. I'm sitting across from my studio mate, Bryce Hall, who is currently doing amazing things at the National Post. He's an illustrator, editorial cartoonist, interactive media creator, editorial creator there. But, you know, I was struggling drawing my own comic. Bryce was struggling, I guess, you know, writing the second issue of his comic. And to be fair, I think this was Bryce being nicer to me than us needing each other, even though that makes a better story. Because Bryce is an amazingly talented artist. He's the detail of his work, if you ever get a chance to see his stuff, I'll show you afterwards. But he was writing a comic called Adam Brochu, had finished the first issue, was struggling somewhat with the second issue, but probably saw me struggling a little bit getting my stuff drawn, the stuff that I wanted to draw myself, and said, hey, did you want to write the second issue of Adam Brochu? And from there, it sort of snowballed. I wrote a lot of second issues where I helped script. Mm-hmm. So Gwen Howarth, at the time, who was living as, who was born as a man, was doing a comic called Omega Zone, and I ended up scripting that. And since then, being a close friend came out to me, and then eventually the rest of the world, but I ended up co-writing her autobiographical experiences in the pages of Toronto Comics in the same way that we collaborate on our science fiction comics that we've done together. So it's definitely been a heck of a ride, and every artist and every collaborator brings their own set of challenges, and I think it's...
You learn a lot, too.
It's wonderful to write a diverse amount of stuff and be influenced by, like, they always say, if you're into superhero comics, you're just going to write bad carbon copies. Be influenced by other things out there, you know? Dwayne's Inferno, we dragged in a lot of Japanese horror films into there with our Toronto Comics story. We brought in a lot of autobiographical material. The second story we're particularly proud of. It was originally going to be a comedy, to be honest, about Gwen's misadventures trying to find a bathroom as a trans woman. And then suddenly, all hell broke loose in the States over, is it Target?
Yeah.
The Target incident about their bathroom policy, and it became a serious issue.
Yeah.
And so we ended up writing something for the time, and even now, that has, I think, a lot wider impact and message in terms of saying, here's someone you don't understand. You know, me personally, you know, I have, as a cisgendered hetero male, I have a lot of trouble relating. But to see it through the eyes of a very close friend and what they're going through and the emotional struggles suddenly opened up your eyes to how sad this all can be and the struggle it can be, and you gain a new degree of empathy and sympathy. So we wanted to take that experience and translate it from Gwen's point of view to tell the world that, hey, it's not easy.
Yeah.
This is my personal struggle. Like, this is what I go through. Like, I take this for granted. You know, that I can just, you know, get up and go. I don't have to search the vicinity, the neighborhood, for an appropriate bathroom. I'm very, very fortunate. So just to be able to, and again, as writing exercises go, the same thing should happen with fictional characters. You imbue them with a life of their own. So some of it can be parts of you. Some of it can be friends and family that you observe around you. Some of it can even come from people you read about, right? You never know what sort of influences. So the fact that this Louis Riel, Sir John A. MacDonald CBC show could come across my path, yeah, and will influence that script for example, you know, and at that point you actually feel like you're saying something, you know. Sure, a superhero book is about the kicksplode. The superhero book is about someone punching someone. So in the first Major North story, where I was writing quite heavy-handedly about Occupy, about the G8 and G20 riots in Toronto, about all the difficult things that our city goes through during those times when you think, oh, we're very open-minded, but then it's nothing like putting your city in sort of spotlight or protests or challenging your own values that makes you want to actually say something. So yeah. I originally wrote about punching a Nazi. The very first Major North story in Toronto Comics is about punching a Nazi at the end of the day. Because I thought, okay, it's about multiculturalism, it's about Occupy, it's about our experiences at the G8 and the G20 that Toronto went through. But then, a couple of years later, Nazi punching is a thing.
Yeah.
I thought, oh, this is just kind of a goofy, old-timey trope that I'd just like to sort of toss in there along with my message, not realizing that it might actually be
real, an
appropriate message.
Yeah.
So art, life,
yeah.
Eh? It's who'd have thought that something like, you know, me being influenced by Captain America punching Hitler in the mouth, and there was actually a Captain Canuck character called Der Führer that was sort of an analog character who turned out to be his archenemy in disguise, actually. But that's a whole other story. But I wanted to write my version of that. And again, this came from the original outline when it was a Captain Canuck story before I evolved it into our own unique character. Wow. So We've talked a lot. you can't shut me up.
No, you have got so many interesting stories. I had other things that I could have brought up.
No worries.
We got to do this again.
To be continued.
Because there's a whole other
life.
Well,
we could even tape our dinner conversations,
too. Yeah, we could.
Too,
there's so many things we could. Because you've got the professional inline skating stuff that I wanted to ask you.
Did you find that, or did someone tell you about it?
I heard about it on another podcast, so we'll save it another time.
Yes.
We'll talk about it.
In Mexico, I was known as Hombre Araña. And essentially, imagine inline speed skating in South American Mexico being like the Jamaican bobsled team. So Canadians competing against people who have nice weather all year round was a unique experience. I do have a story I could share that's Spider-Man related as well that we can share. A few quick plugs if that's
absolutely
cool with
go
you.
Feel
free to Google Major North, Victorian Four, Zip Kramer, or Sam Noir Comics and Toys, and you'll find all of my different stuff. I've plugged a lot of anthologies as well that I've... Strange Romance Volume 2 has a Kickstarter campaign on right now, so feel free to go look for that. There's a brand new color Zip Kramer story, Zip Kramer being the galaxy's worst hero ever. So I'll leave it at that. And this is following our successful Kickstarter campaign for the Zip Kramer graphic novel. So I'd like to thank folks out there. Also, our mutual friends, Shane Heron.
Right.
And Martin Slam Duncan for introducing Eric and I. Shane's just literally, I think, tomorrow by our time, whenever this podcast goes up, Shane's new comic book series, Morris, a supernatural western, will be out in the world, so I'd like to give Shane a shout out.
Congratulations, Shane.
And the Fastball Special.
That's right.
Is also something we should give a shout out to.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much. And no I'm worries. Happy that you quit the corporate world and you're part of the comic community.
All my friends feel like, you know, my friends that I've known for years and years, they feel like I've run away and joined the circus.
Okay.
It's hilarious.
But you're
it's hilarious.
Now.
We're at dinner parties. It's like, so he did what now? See, they're like this with me when I'm at dinner parties. I can only imagine how they're talking amongst themselves, you know. And I have the cartoon. It's cartoonish, but you know they're sitting there sipping their tea with their pinkies up, going, "My word, he's done what now?" Which isn't the case.
But you got a constant smile on your face, which is what matters.
That is true. I do what I love, and I can only tell the rest of the world, if what you love to do is podcast and have cool conversations with geeky people that share the love of what you do, keep doing it.
Exactly. I'm happier for it, too. Awesome. Well, thank you,
and thanks
everybody.
For having me.
Oh, absolutely. We got to do this again. There's so many other things we got to talk about. Thank you, everybody, for listening. This has been The Cave of Solitude with Sam Noir, and we will be back soon.